Welcome to this week's Breezy Breakfast. Today, we present a provincial election postmortem. Why was the voter turnout so low? Is proportional representation the answer? Did the Conservative run the best campaign? Our guests this week are Mike Schreiner, Guelph Green MPP, NDP candidate Aisha Jangir, Bill McBain, past Ontario Queen's Park insider and current radio broadcast journalist, and communist candidate Juanita Burnett.
Welcome everyone to another Breezy Breakfast, a special Ontario election post-mortem. We are joined today by birthday boy Mike Schreiner, newly elected MPP for Guelph, Bill McBain, political analyst and political backroomer. Bill was most famously in my mind campaign chairperson for Charlie Angus when he ran for the leadership of the New Democrats. We will be joined shortly by Aisha Jahanagir, who decided to really do a children's crusade and run, despite being from Guelph, in the riding that was currently held by Doug Ford, in order to raise issues that were of concern to her, in particularly health care. And we are also joined by Juanita Burnett, a perennial Communist Party candidate in Guelph, who has been a longtime Breezy Breakfast member and correspondent, and has felt it incumbent upon her to be with us and in elections to raise issues that she believes matters to working and other people in Ontario. So welcome to all of you. Mike, as I said, a very, very happy birthday. You won Guelph rather handily, as I think what one would describe as a lopsided victory. And I was wondering if you would like to provide us with any thoughts and reflections on the election and on Ontario going forward.
Yeah, well, thanks, Phil. And great to see Juanita and Bill. Bill and I had an opportunity to do a number of interviews during the RIP period on his radio show, and always appreciate that. And Juanita, I'll just say to you and all the candidates in Guelph, great job compared to the rest of the province. Guelph had one of the highest voter turnouts in an election that had an abysmally low turnout, unfortunately. And so I would say locally, I'll just express a lot of gratitude for people in Guelph re-electing me and all the people who worked on my campaign. And one of the lessons I've learned is just, and this is going to apply to Ontario politics, is how important grassroots organizing is, how important being like engaged in the community, listening to people, mobilizing people, like being their voice and amplifying people's voices in the community and in the legislature is to politics. And I would say, in the interest of nonpartisanship, I would say that applies to Joel Hardin and Ottawa Centre. And, you know, Joel and I both had, like, he had a few hundred more votes than me. So we were the two top vote getters in the province. And I think Joel does a lot of like community-based organizing work, and I feel like I do the same. And I think that's a lesson for politicians across the province. I think we really have to have a deep think about democracy right now. To have the lowest voter turnout in the history of the province, I think is criticism that's well-deserved to all politicians, and I would include myself in that. And all political leaders, especially, and just I think the parties are going to have to really rethink how you engage and mobilize voters and people in our communities in democracy. And I think in some respects, I've thought a lot about this in the last week, is it's not just in Ontario, it's a worldwide phenomenon right now where you're seeing a decline in citizen engagement, voter turnout, grassroots organizing, community, et cetera. And so I can't think of a better group than Breezy Breakfast to have that kind of conversation, because here's a collection of individuals who really deeply believe in community and political engagement. And so I'm really, in some ways, wanting to listen and learn from all of you in that regard. And one of the reasons I think it's going to be so important is, and I've done a lot of media interviews since last Thursday, about, you know, the fact that, you know, I'm kind of the only opposition leader without the word interim in front of their name right now, and what that means for Queen's Park and Ontario politics moving forward, is I think we're going to have, given the, you know, strong majority in seats the Ford government has in the legislature, though I will remind everyone that 18% of the population actually voted for a conservative in this election, and obviously slightly more than 40% of those who chose to vote. So, you know, however you slice and dice it, a minority of Ontarians, and in the case of total voters, a small minority of Ontarians actually voted for this government. So it's going to take, I think, a lot of grassroots organizing, community mobilization of citizens groups, community groups, social justice groups, environmental groups, to push back against the excesses of the Ford government. And the things I'm most concerned about are privatization of public services of care, whether that's disability supports or children and youth in care, health care, which has been an obvious one. I would say a sleeper is education, and then obviously the environmental policies, especially with the sprawl agenda, the highway agenda. And so I think we're all going to have to figure out how we, you know, engage, mobilize, organize people to push back, and how political leaders and parties and elected officials, particularly those on the opposition benches, engage with, amplify, and support those grassroots movements. And so that's really where a lot of my thinking is, because I would say one of the lessons of this election is that many of us failed to do that in this election. And we can say it's partly driven by the pandemic. We can say it's partly driven by it wasn't a change election, but I think those explanations are unsatisfactory. I will say that I do think the media and the way polling works contributed to it, because there was so much talk about strategic voting and who's going to vote for who and who's going to be, you know, the progressive alternative to the conservatives. And I've talked to a lot of voters who just felt confused about who to vote for and why you should choose to vote, that it was so much about strategic voting and not about issues people care about or the kind of Ontario people want moving forward. And so, you know, I think those of us who are engaged in politics are going to have to figure out how to navigate a media environment that really focuses on the horse race, polling, strategic voting conversations, and not about like policies, vision, values, how government affects people's day-to-day lives. And so the intersection of all of that is going to be, I think, a really important lesson to learn from this election and an important conversation moving forward as we think about how to re-engage people in the political process. And I think I'll leave it at there, because I want to give other panelists time to talk. And also just, I want to listen in on the conversation, because I need to hear from all of you.
So Juanita, I wanted to start with you as well as a local candidate, because you are local. Give us your take on the election, and, you know, be completely open. The Liberals, the Greens, and the NDP didn't seem to catch fire with anyone. What were you seeing? What are your feelings about the election? Are you going to do it again? And if you want, you can announce if you're going to run municipally as well. Be curious.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm not running municipally. I'm not doing that. It sounds like a lot of new people are running this time, and I think that's wonderful. I could probably be persuaded to run provincially again, especially since now the signs have my name on them, which is kind of cool. It's a big deal. I think a lot about 80 seats, and that's really, really overwhelming. I think conversations that didn't happen had a lot to do with that. I think the Ford government and their choice not to engage with people was a really effective strategy. And I think that's really, really disappointing. I think the mainstream media had something to do with it, partly because there is limited mainstream media now, for one thing. I think they could have pushed harder to get answers. And I know some people tried. The smaller media outlets just were tuned out, and that's not right, but that's how they won, I think. One of the things I've been thinking a lot about is the non-issue that the pandemic had in the election, and it should have been a huge thing. And I think one of the reasons Ford was reelected is because he survived. And I think in an unprecedented thing like the pandemic, the fact that things might have gone really bad or relatively worse, but more to the point that no one else had to deal with anything like that in a long time. So I guess that Ford survived, like literally, may have got him votes and may have been seen as a way that he dealt with the pandemic, when in fact there were so many other things that could have and should have been done in the pandemic to help more people and to clear it up a little quicker. So I did want to say congratulations to Mike, and I think he made a really good point about the importance of community engagement. And I will say Mike doesn't just engage with the community for photo ops, he actually pitches in and helps.
Thank you very much, Juanita. You provided us with some real fodder for later on, as did Mike, with regards to issues of strategic voting, the best election campaign, and also the role of the media at this point. And we're gonna be following up on those. Your comment about Mike is important, because Mike, I've got some windows that need washing, and I'm glad to know that you are prepared to pitch in and help me with that. That's great. That's the kind of MPP that I want. Now, I'd just like to go to Bill McBain, our out of town guest from the big city of Mississauga. As I said, Bill is a party insider with the New Democrats, although Bill might say he's not much of an insider right now. Bill has had his finger on the pulse of Ontario as long as I've known him, and I think that's getting on to 40 years now. Bill, you and I had a quick chat, and I think we shared views of what some of the issues were that were missing, everything from leadership to dynamism to policy. Let's hear from you.
Thank you for the invitation, Phil, and it's at least 40 years. The turnout was disturbing. I did a bit of knocking on doors for a fellow I know in Tom Rakusevic, who is the Humber River Black Creek MPP, and he was just reelected. The turnout in that riding was 29%, 29% in a Toronto riding. Disturbing. Absolutely disturbing. So why aren't people getting out? Well, I can't speak to all the other campaigns as well as I could probably speak to the NDP campaign. One, the NDP for a long time now, at least as long as Andrew Horvath's been leader, has not talked about the future in a big way. It was common for CCF even and NDP leaders to win or lose, to give a sense of what the future was if you voted Social Democratic. that you would get, and I think the term that was often used is that you would get to the metaphorical shining city on the hill. In other words, it was aspirational. It was aspirational, and there was always a sense of future. We're very pocketbook-based now. We're very immediate. And I think at a time when there's so many stresses on people, there's so much complexity in the airwaves, I think there needs to be a sense of where we can get to, not just where we are, because people aren't having a great time where they are. And having that sort of aspirational vision, I think, is very, very important. As much as I think issues are important in campaigns, which personally, I think they're important, but are they big vote motivators? No. When people are standing over the ballot and they're thinking of the ballot question, which all political parties want to get people to, they want to put that idea in their minds of why they're going to vote for them. I don't think people are sitting over their ballot saying, I'm going to vote because of issue X, Y, or Z. Or if they do, it is the excuse, not the reason. The reason is they may have voted Liberal their entire lives, but if they were polled and asked, why are you voting Liberal today? It's because of policy X, policy Y, policy Z. I think getting back to grassroots politics, absolutely. The NDP and the Liberal Party, very much so, has always been highly centralized. The NDP, not always, in recent years, has been highly centralized. The network they had at one time of highly effective riding organizations, of training riding people, of having a sustainable crew wherever you went in the province of Ontario, doesn't exist anymore. I have not worked for the Ontario NDP officially for several elections, and I haven't wanted to. I volunteered with candidates that I think a great deal of. I talked to candidates I think a great deal of, people like Peter Tabbins, who I've pulled vote for, John Vantoff, who I ran his first election, the people like that. And I've been helpful where I can, but I haven't been deeply involved in the campaign. I was on federal staff all of last year, up until just past the election, which it was great to get back in. But that's federal politics, and the federal NDP is a very different animal than the provincial NDP. But we have some serious issues. We have not just issues around a leader, and I don't want anyone to think that if we replace the leader of the party, same for the Liberals, that the world's going to be a different place. There are structural issues. There are issues of local organization, of local contact, of valuing members and local voices, of training people at the local level and building capacity, and on and on and on it goes. We've got a lot of work to do because, quite frankly, the organization on several levels, I think, is profoundly broken. But I do agree with a number of points that that folks have been making this morning. I think the loss of and lack of local media is a profound problem. I interview Mike on the only English language radio station not on a campus in Peel Region. Peel Region has the sixth and ninth largest cities in Canada, has a large population in a large rural area, And we have two newspapers I can't speak for the Brampton Guardian in the same way, but the Mississauga News, is the chief function of that newspaper is to keep the Canadian Tire Flyer dry. And it does that well. I've tested it a few times. And then there's our radio station, which has no news section, and has some profoundly right-wing, scary people on doing shows. The one before me in a show I was doing through the election, the guy would make Rush Limbaugh proud. In fact, Rush might have felt a bit liberal. And it's just... It's profoundly damaging that when you go out and you knock on doors and you hear a lot of these lines reflected back that you hear on right-wing media, on AM radio in particular, talk radio, that you hear on podcasts, the 1% has essentially weaponized a portion of the rest of the population to agitate on their behalf against their own interests. And those are the lines that are in people's heads. And I used to dismiss it, but I've had numerous phone calls from people I knew in high school over the last year of people panicked in different ways or angry, spewing stuff back to me that is unrecognizable as part of the reality that we're currently existing in. So if that is the best argument I've heard for the multiverse, is that in fact that's out there. But all joking aside, I want to say very clearly that, and I told Mike this on the show, and I off air, I said it on my own show on air, Mike Shiner was the best performer, bar none, in the leadership debate. And in terms of the local region I live in, Mike Shiner was present physically, emotionally, and intellectually to deal with the issues around urban sprawl, around highway construction, loss of farmland, water quality, air quality, housing, jobs, all those things. He turned up. I cannot say that easily of the other political parties. Now, in fairness to Stephen Del Duca, he had the history of actually canceling 413 as a former minister. But I believe they were not opposed, as at least not viscerally opposed to the Bradford bypass. And Mike Shiner showed up. Not only that, he had a coherent, well-spoken platform that was more social democratic, that was more progressive on a whole range of issues, and quite frankly, better written. And as Mike and I discussed one day, the NDP virtually lifted the mental health policy and made it their own, with a little bit of missing on how to pay for it, because Mike just did a better job of that. And the one guy in the small party in the legislature produced a more coherent, progressive platform across the board, outside of the how they're usually identified, was just the environment. And it made it, and it was impressive. Now, this did not pay huge dividends in this election in terms of vote, but I'm going to bet dollars to donuts that that's going to roll around in people's heads. And 4 years from now, it'll be a huge advantage for the Green Party if Mike Lunt is still the leader of the party. Anyway, I've had far, 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 far too much to say. My apologies. Mike's used to hearing me on the radio having far, 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 far too much to say, and or anyone else that listens to me. But I actually have quite a bit more to say about the nature of the NDP. But I think basically we need to be in touch with the folks. We have to have a grounded democracy that responds to local needs. We need to have proportional representation, a system that works well, that reflects people's desires, and we have to govern in the public interest and have a sense, most importantly, of a sense of future to give people a sense of hope. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Bill. I'm going to return to the proportional representation question, and I will just pose it for now. And that the question is, does this election actually provide us with the impetus to purport for proportional representation? And I think in particular of my Liberal friends, regrettably, I could not find a Liberal to join us today. But here they are with 23% of the vote, and they have a handful of seats, and nothing suggests to me more than that, that it is a time for PR. But having said that, we'll come back to it. Let's hear from Aisha, who wanted to be the dragon killer. Aisha, welcome back to Guelph from your time in Etobicoke. You don't look too scarred from it. Let's hear from you. What was it like to take on the premier?
I ran in Etobicoke North, the riding where Doug Ford is MPP. And the reason why I did that was because I couldn't bear not taking action. So there's already this sentiment of, you know, fear and anxiety around, you know, a lot of the uncertainty with the rise in cost of living, mental health or mental illness, the rise of mental illness. I knew what the Conservatives were proposing to do, and I wanted to, you know, take part and do whatever I could to take action. And of course, this is not done alone. I had a great team of friends and supports. In fact, many people from my previous campaign, and I'd like to mention, you know, Bonnie and Brittany, who were on this morning, played an active role and were part of the leadership team supporting me in the campaign in Etobicoke North. And they did an absolutely fabulous job. It was a very, very different campaign. I remember when I got nominated, it was writ drop day. So we had very little time, if any, to prepare for a campaign. We had limited resources. It was a riding association that didn't even exist in Etobicoke North. It was a riding that was neglected, to be honest. I spent every single day with people that are from Etobicoke North, a small set of people. There were like six very well connected. And we would door knock every single day, trying to understand the riding and connecting with the people in the riding. Their issues were not any different than what we have here and across the province. So I knew that NDP and what we were presenting as in the form of policies and part of our platform was, you know, one way of responding to their urgent need for help. I've said this before, in times of hopelessness, what you need is action. And I spoke and spent lots of time at the door. I was speaking to people that probably, some of them admitted that they had never voted before, and tried to inspire somebody to, this is the time to vote, right? This is an election, and I know you've heard it before, that it's an important election, but it truly is so important right now. I spoke to people that were on ODSP, people that were struggling with drugs and alcohol, people concerned about their teenage children, legitimate, real concerns that clearly Doug Ford or any previous government has really neglected to address. There were Doug Ford signs absolutely everywhere. I mean, talk about violating bylaws. Like, it was funny. It was flooded with Doug Ford signs. But the one thing I kept on hearing was that he's never present. You know, he wouldn't respond to them. And despite me offering hope, the turnout was still very low. In 2018, the turnout for that election in Etobicoke North was 49% of people didn't vote. And for this election, only 33% of the people from that riding voted. Despite us having like advanced polls that were for 10 days, I felt like I was doing get out the vote, you know, for that last 10 days. The get out the vote has never been so successful as it was for this election. And I truly mean it. I've sat through and I've participated through Get Out the Vote in previous elections, but this one was very well organized. People knew what they were doing. And they led us, they directed us to where we needed to be to get out the vote. We tried our very best. I know some of the core team members are still, they're still sort of digesting with the results. They're scared about what is to come. And I continue to worry. We went into, you know, the roughest neighborhoods of Etobicoke North. I really, really hope that Doug Ford does not get through with everything that he's proposing. It's scary. And I agree with you, Mike. We gotta come up with ways to respond, you know, gathering people and rallying and protesting. But I don't know. It is what it is. It took us a few days to sort of catch up on our sleep, and I think we're all pretty good now. It was exhilarating. It was different. And I'm glad I put my name forward. gave it really our best shot.
Well, thank you for taking the stand for democracy, Aisha. I'm going to just ask you a couple of quick questions because going into Mordor the way that you did, I'm wondering, one of the things that Doug Ford stated post-election, and I'd love to hear from Mike on this as well, is that we were going to be seeing a kinder, gentler Doug Ford. And I'm wondering, what did you see in Etobicoke? And is there any evidence that we're seeing a Bill Davis style of Doug Ford coming out, which basically means a premier for the province? Or is this just all smoke and mirrors?
My opinion? I think it's, I think time will tell. I unfortunately don't trust what he has said to the public. It's going to be wait and see. You know, him getting it done, we'll see what he can eventually get done. And if in turn it's going to hurt people, because that's my fear and concern. Is he a changed man? Again, we'll have to wait and see. I'm not going to comment if he truly is. But one thing is for sure, people from Etobicoke North did not feel supported by Doug Ford. It's just unfortunate that they didn't make their ways to the polls and send that message loud and clear. Because if there was anyone that could have ruled him out or voted him out, it would have been his people.
Yep. Mike, your role is a little different now. You're going to be in the legislature. Are you going to make Doug Ford accountable for his principles of kinder, gentler that he's espoused and inclusiveness? And then I'll hear from Bill McBain because I saw him nod his head as well. Mike?
Yeah, Phil, we'll have to see. I'll say the Toronto Star did Doug a favor. Like they really, particularly my friend, Martin Reg Cohen, who I'm going to give an earful to when I get back to Queen's Park, certainly presented to Ontarians that Doug Ford was a changed man and a different politician. And I think that's unfortunate because if you look at what they didn't really have a platform, but what they campaigned on, I would say particularly from a climate perspective, was abysmal. I mean, literally they're gonna pave over the farmland that feeds us, the wetlands that protect us. They're gonna ramp up climate pollution. They're gonna advance a sprawl agenda that's primarily going to benefit about 12 extremely wealthy developers, et cetera. And then on the caring side of things, you know, he talked a lot about building hospitals and long-term care homes and things like that, but he never once talked about the actual people who deliver that care and supporting those people, ensuring they're fairly compensated, that they have, you know, benefits, full-time work, you know, good working conditions, et cetera. And so we'll see. I think one of the most interesting things about this election, and Bill, I'd love your take on this, given your long history with the NDP, was the realignment of so many private sector unions behind the Ford government and the number of endorsements Ford secured from private sector unions that just a few years ago were part of the Working Families Coalition, you know, running attack ads, you know, on Tim Hudak, for example, and other conservative leaders. And so I think between the pandemic, the even progressive media outlets like the Star, and then private sector unions all gave, I would argue, Ford a shield that he was a changed person and a more caring, compassionate Bill Davis kind of conservative leader. But I don't see much evidence of that in what he actually campaigned on, what you see in the conservative budget. And so, you know, we'll see. But to answer your question about holding him accountable, absolutely. With the help of a lot of everyday Ontarians who I think are going to have to really speak out.
Thanks, Mike. Let's hear from Bill, and then we're going to go to Juanita on this because Juanita's just chomping to get at this one.
Chomping the bit. Well, for those unions, by the way, for the most part, were construction unions. And particularly LIUNA 183 has a long, 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 long history with the Liberal Party and hence the Working Families Coalition. So they didn't, those particular unions didn't have a lot of history with the NDP. Some of the construction unions have gravitated in and out over the years, but largely they've been associated with the Liberal Party or whoever delivers their idea of whatever they consider job-rich construction jobs. And of course, 183 is going to be that, at least on a short-term basis, although if they were to reinvest that money in other sorts of infrastructure projects, they would create a lot more long-term jobs and have much more positive impact on the economy and environment of this province.
Bill, let me interrupt you for just a second.
Yeah.
When you said that, it suddenly struck me. There is a particular self-interest that this union might have. Is that 413? And maybe Mike can comment on that.
Highway 413 is with the unions I was referring to are the construction unions, and LIUNA, which is the largest labor's union in the province. They have other units, but the largest one, 183, is historically supporters of the Liberal Party. And a lot of their support is based on who's going to be delivering construction projects, which is, you know, somewhat understandable, even though I disagree with them. In terms of Ford being kinder and gentler, no, absolutely not. Ford used the pandemic as a screen for some good behavior on the top. He handled the pandemic, and he was somewhat critical of the convoy, the types, extremists. And I guess that seemed a little better than most people would have expected from Ford. But as Mike said, did a whole lot of things that were quite reprehensible, including just a host of ministerial zoning orders and exemptions, the profound restriction across the province of the powers of local conservation authorities to protect water and have impact on proposed projects. So, I think Ford will not be kinder and gentler. Mike, you might be able to answer this. Are they calling their house back early? I understand fairly early to start rolling through things through the legislature. The other thing that gave him cover, by the way, if people noticed, was the tight relationship between Ford and Justin Trudeau. All the announcements on projects and spending running into that election was mind-numbing. And, you know, the federal Liberal Party is this seemed to leave the Ontario Liberal Party in deep water.
Thanks for that. Mike, do you have any comments on the legislature coming back?
Yeah, just really quick though, on Bill's point about the federal Liberal Party. Oh my gosh, it was like Justin Trudeau, like up until writ day, was campaigning for Ford. Like it was unbelievable. Like really. So anyway, legislature coming back early. I'm hearing mixed messages on that, but I did get a little inside information yesterday that possibly coming back early July, which sucks for me because I was planning on going on a canoe trip the first week of July. So we'll see. But the rumors are, and none of this is validated, it's all rumors at this point, that they would come back, pass the budget, and then close, like, so be back for like a week, 10 days maybe, to pass the budget. But I think they want to minimize the number of question periods and opportunities the opposition has to hold them accountable. So they'll ram it through as fast as possible, I think.
Thank you. Now let's hear from Juanita on this, on the kinder, cuddlier Doug Ford.
Yeah, I can't even be optimistic about that. I have no faith at all that he has become a kinder, gentler person. But I know there was a comment somewhere in the chat that Susan made about him feeling challenged enough to put that on. And I think it's important to remember that if we can push and push, he will either back down on things or be challenged in court and lose in court eventually. It's not going to be easy. It's a lot of fires to put out, but if we can push back he does seem to be movable when there's enough force against him. Thanks.
Great. Now, just I want to just do a sideways segue. And this is going to be perhaps my most contentious question today, but I'm going to do it anyway. And this includes the Liberals, the NDP, and the Greens. I would argue that the Conservatives ran the best campaign of all the parties. I didn't like it, but they were the ones that strategically understood what they had to or didn't have to do to get elected. And I'd love to hear from both Mike crossing the province and Bill following the province on what you think of that. Were the Conservatives as good as I think they were, or am I just drinking the Kool-Aid?
I will have to admit, Phil, that I think you're right. As much as I detested their campaign, and I would argue it was a campaign of voter suppression in many respects because of just the complete lack of engagement. The fact that, you know, if I could just say in Guelph, like, you know, I disagree with Peter McSherry on most of the issues and don't understand how he could ever run for the Conservative Party. But I will say he's somebody I've known. He's a decent, good person. He's very, you know, he's involved in a number of community projects, volunteers for a number of things, is a respected lawyer, is an intelligent person. And the fact that he wasn't even allowed by the central party to go to a single debate, do media interviews, anything, like not allowed to say a word. And that was the kind of campaign they ran across the province. It was so centrally and tightly controlled. And the strategy was that if they could suppress the vote as much as possible, they would get enough of their folks out to win the election. And they executed it. As reprehensible as I find it, they executed it almost flawlessly. And then I will say, having experience in one of the ridings that almost knocked off a Conservative in Parry Sound Muskoka that's always ever voted Conservative, and the Greens came within a couple thousand votes of actually winning that riding. The negative campaign they ran against us in the last 7 days and and just the blatant misinformation. If there was one thing I would learn just from a tactical and strategic level on the ground, is we did not do an effective enough job of pushing back against the negative ads that were blatant disinformation. And, you know, Bill had talked about some of the conversations he had knocking on doors with Tom, which, by the way, Tom's one of my favorite NDP MPPs. I have tons of respect, and he and I have worked together on a number of issues. I had people literally screaming at me. I had people coming up to me in Parry Sound Muskoka, like just on the street, screaming at me, saying like, how can you live with yourself that you're going to take all of our ways of heating our home out of our house and making it illegal to use natural gas or oil, propane, or anything? And I'm like, that's not what we're proposing. And I'm like, where did you hear that? And he's like, well, it's all over YouTube. It's all over Facebook. It's all over, you know, my local radio station that you're going to make us freeze in the dark. And I had that. I had a number of people come up to me on that. People, there was ads running that we were going to close down all the hospitals in Parry Sound Muskoka. Like, what? like what? like we were calling for a bigger expansion of healthcare budget than the Conservatives. But so that's just a couple of examples, at least in a riding where it was close and the Conservatives felt they had to fight tooth and nail to hang on to it. And I would say we did not do an effective enough job of pushing back, responding, and against that level of highly funded, highly targeted negative campaigning and just misinformation, disinformation.
Bill, what about you?
I think that they were very effective. They were very disciplined. A couple things, just FYI, there are rumors that the federal Conservatives are hiring Roger Stone as an advisor. So it can only get better in Canada if that's true. In 1990, when David Peterson was losing, the Liberal premier, he went around at the end saying, people, children would starve in the streets if the NDP was elected. And it didn't have much cachet because it was unsophisticated. The modern Conservative Party and the modern right wing is highly sophisticated. They understand social media. They're much more disciplined than we are. And by we, I mean everybody else at using these tools. It's a problem in our democracy. It's a severe problem in our democracy right across the Western world. North America, I would say, in particular. So they were very good at it. I was trying to get a hold of phone numbers to talk to conservative candidates and MPPs after they were elected on election night. I phoned conservative headquarters and talked to four people about getting phone numbers. And I couldn't get one because they didn't want people talking to their members. They were that disciplined. I phoned the Liberal Party headquarters and they sent me a sheet right away. And everyone else I had because I was able to contact their offices. And that they highly controlled the not only the message, but the ability for people to speak at all who weren't Doug Ford or those people designated on a particular day. Do I think they're reprehensible? Yes. Did they come across, did Ford come across the smiling, fun guy who liked to meet people and shake hands? The disinformation he spewed on in the leadership debate alone was quite amazing, but he did it smiling the whole time. And it worked. They're well-trained. Their communications is superb. And it's something going to need to get a lot better at without hiring Roger Stone. And speaking of unions, I'll note that in Parry Sound, Muskoka, a couple of traditional supporters of the New Democratic Party in terms of education unions supported the Green candidate, Matt Richter, if I'm right about that, just a little, yeah. Okay, we got a problem.
Okay.
Here in River City.
And because I don't want this to be a total downer, I'm going to move to what I hope is the future. And I'm going to start, Bill, you, I think, paid Mike the supreme compliment by stating that the Green Party's campaign was grassroots, listening, and engaged. And I saw on the chat that there are people that are concerned that perhaps the future of grassroots democracy is local and group activism, and that we have to be very concerned about democracy. Well, I want to turn that concern around. And in particular, I want to focus on the Liberal Party a bit. And I hope, Mike, you don't mind commenting on this. Is the future for democracy proportional representation? And how do we get there? And I'll ask Aisha and Juanita and Bill all to weigh in on this. Mike, future PR?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Greens and the NDP have been calling for proportional representation for forever. How we get there is the big question. Hopefully the Liberals, after the experience they had in this election, will actually buy into the fact that we need a fundamental rethink of our electoral system. And here's the challenge we face, because there's a lot of talk about the Liberals, Greens, and NDP merging and forming, you know, one progressive party. But you know, I look at what's happening to the Democrats in the U.S., where progressive Democrats are at war with like centrist Democrats and unable to really bring forward a progressive agenda. And so I think if the three progressive parties merged, we'd probably be in a very similar situation in Ontario and in Canada. And so I think proportional representation gets us out of that dilemma and actually could bring forward the kind of coalition government that would really represent the democratic will of the people and bring forward the progressive changes we need, especially on climate, because climate's going to require some fundamental changes in the way we live, like that is going to be deeply personal for people. And that's why it's such a challenge to address it. And I think it would be hard for a majority government to deliver that kind of transformational change, given the public pushback. So I think it's gonna require parties working together. And I'll finally just say to the Conservatives, so I'm hoping the Liberals will wake up. To the Conservatives, I'll just say, you know, you've had two federal elections where you've got the most votes and the Liberals have formed government. So it's not working for you all either. I would argue it's not working for anyone. You know, whether we can actually deliver PR, I don't know. Because the forces against it are strong. My hope is that something like a citizens assembly would help move it forward. And I know that's something that Fair Vote is pushing for. But the reality we're going to face over the next 4 years is I don't think there's any way the conservatives are going to support something like electoral reform. And so my hope is the three opposition parties can come together at least on proportional representation and electoral reform going into the next election.
Sure. And when you've got the combination to the safe, you don't normally give it up. Juanita and then Aisha, and then I'll go to Bill on this one. Juanita, PR, is this going to be the saving grace of democracy?
It could be if we can manage to do it. What Mike said is absolutely true. I don't think combining any sort of progressive combo party is going to be the fix, because there are too many things going on to try to come together about everything. I think mixed member proportional representation would bring enough people to the table that could have progressive discussions about things and push forward for what people actually need.
Aisha, proportional representation, where do you stand on this?
Oh, definitely. We're in need for proportional representation, and I would support mixed member proportional representation. But do I see it coming with the majority conservatives in our province? Absolutely not. That's not crossing their minds at all. So it's going to be a hard fight. You know, maybe on a federal level, they may consider that. I'm not sure, because we saw the Liberals, even though they had the popular vote, ended up with very few seats. So even though it's very appealing to some of the parties, conservatives are not going to be on board. Yeah,
fun fact about federal politics is that had we had proportional representation as Justin Trudeau had committed to in his first election, the Liberals would have been able to draw cabinet ministers from Saskatchewan and from Alberta without having to reach into the Senate as they did so long ago. Bill, PR, give us your take on it. And also, since you've been on the inside, what are the obstacles to getting it besides clearly the Conservatives right now being in power?
Well, electoral reform, proportional representation, mixed member, there are a number of versions. I think it's very important, but I don't think it's the silver bullet or the magic bullet at all for saving democracy. I think we need a much more broad set of changes to bring people into the system. The biggest challenge we have to our democracy is a sense of efficacy in the population. PR would certainly help that, but I'm fond of quoting John Kenneth Galbraith, who said that people who don't feel served by a process don't participate in it. And there's a lot more going on than simply the challenges around voting. Local media, information, engagement, empowerment, sense of future, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of things going on. The Liberal Party isn't what I would call a big supporter of PR either. They said they were, but when push came to shove, suddenly they weren't. Why, as you said earlier, they had the keys, why would they give them up? There have been a number of cases where there have been referendums around the country, in British Columbia, nationally. Was it nationally or was it just Ontario? Anyway, there have been a number of referendums around accepting PR that were defeated. They weren't defeated a little, they were defeated a lot. People didn't understand what it would mean. People are hesitant to change. I think one of the big barriers is government is going to have to make the decision in the legislature, and that is the decision, like most other things, and not take it to referendum, or we may never see it. Government's going to have to decide to, representative democracy is going to have to flex its muscles, so to speak, and work for the interests of people and vote in a system that that becomes the electoral law of the land. That's a major barrier.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to turn a little bit and then I'm going to turn a lot. And the first question I'm going to ask is, what about an Australian style of ballot where voting is mandatory? You don't have to vote for any particular person. You just have to show up at the ballot box. Do we need to consider that for Ontario and Canada?
I'll be hugely unpopular for saying this, but I think Australia's got it right. It's not onerous. If you don't show up, you get a fine, a minimal fine. But do I think it has improved the nature of Australian politics? I do not.
Juanita, what about yourself?
It would be really challenging to force people to vote when they aren't having the time, energy, information to get properly, get all the information they need to make a real vote. So I think proportional representation might be more important in getting to somewhere that we could have mandatory voting.
I think people are feeling quite powerless in our current system. And I agree with Juanita, if they have the information that they need in order to make a decision, is very important. Mandatory voting, I hate to say that, you know, that may be something that we have to seriously consider. I was hoping that people would have some reason to vote, right? Versus being told that they must vote, otherwise they're faced with a fine. But I think what's really important was the media, Toronto Star, like it was a sleepy election. People didn't even know that it was happening, to be honest. And who actually felt the most, you know, negative? I mean, really, it's the people that that missed out, right? They opted not to vote because there was no real reason to vote, or they didn't have all the information they needed in order to make that decision. Whatever it was, I think that needs to be addressed first, and then look at mandatory voting if necessary.
Okay, quickly to Mike and then Kevin Bowman, and then I want to talk about the Liberals and the NDP for a second.
Yeah, so I think I'd agree with what Aisha just said, that I think there's a lot of reforms that would need to take place before I would even want to consider or support mandatory voting. So making Election Day a holiday so people don't have to go to work that day, lowering the voting age to 16, because there's so many studies showing that if you vote that first time, you've created a lifelong voter. And for a lot of people who are just leaving home at 18, like figuring out even where to vote, and if you're on the voters list, becomes more complicated than I think a lot of people realize. I've gone through that with my own daughter when she first went to university, and luckily she had a dad who was willing to take her to the returning office and walk through all the steps to make sure she could vote. So I think there's a lot of other reforms that I would prefer to have us try before we resort to something like mandatory voting.
At the risk of sounding like a scolding teacher, I would encourage folks to do their homework. I've heard a couple people say that Justin Trudeau supported proportional representation until he didn't, but that's not true. He did promise to end first past the post, but he never supported PR. He wants something different. I would also encourage folks who are talking about previous referenda around proportional representation in Canada. That has happened. However, in every single case, the government in charge at the time did like basically no public education about the choice that was being made. Most people went into the ballot box having no preparation to answer that question. And so asking people to choose between a system they're comfortable and familiar with and something new they know nothing about is not a fair question. That's ridiculous. If Canada's or any part of Canada is going to put proportional representation to a referendum question, we should do it the way New Zealand did it, where they implemented the system first, let the voters use it, and then ask them to choose whether they want to keep it or go back to the old system. That is a fair question to the voting public. And in terms of mandatory voting, I agree with the previous comments that there would have to be other changes first, because if you're going to fine people who can't vote, that's pretty draconian against working class people who literally cannot get away to vote, even though supposedly they're legally entitled to like a 2-hour break. We know employers don't necessarily do that, or it's an unpaid break, or the closest voting booth is far enough away that they can't do it in those 2 hours. Like, there's way too many barriers to voting right now to implement any kind of fine against people who can't do it. That's not fair. So to Mike's point, yeah, we need a public holiday or something. And I would also say that forcing people to vote under threat of fine shouldn't be done unless they can vote none of the above. That should be an option.
Well, fortunately, there was a none of the above party running candidates in 43 ridings in this election. So that kind of was an option. It's 4 clear hours to vote, I believe, is the time your employer is supposed to give you. It's 4 clear hours. Is it a problem for people? Of course it is. And you're quite right about Trudeau. That is a fair correction of my comments. He did promise to end first past the post. That didn't happen. And yeah, you are absolutely correct. Those referendums were not supported by the government of the day in any way, shape, or form.
Thanks, Bill. And Britt, I think, Britt, you're a newcomer to Breezy Corners, but you want to contribute to this discussion, and welcome aboard.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been a few times, but just popped in here and there. But I just wanted to add, before you can institute mandatory voting, we really need to take accessibility issues seriously. Majority of polling stations, just like government offices, even though they say they're accessible, they are not to a lot of people. And even calling, when voters are calling to have people come to their house for voting, they were told they can vote in a few days. Or there were certain hours that they could meet for them to come in to vote. So you can't restrict people when their illnesses are so inconsistent, I guess, the best way to put it. Just making sure that you're taking these accommodations seriously. And if there are gonna be penalties and fines, that the money's not going back to the government, it's going back to the community, to those people that they're not including. Because otherwise they're never going to be taken seriously. Right now, the AODA hasn't been taken seriously for years, and it's not going to, because the fines and restrictions are easier for large corporations to just pay rather than to accommodate people. So it's a fifth of our population that has some form of a disability, and that's a large proportion of the population that is eligible voters that we're just neglecting from the get-go.
Thank you very much. I've heard loudly and clearly that there are some structural issues that we need to address. And I think perhaps the issue of accessibility, not just for those that have accessibility issues, but for everyone, is extremely important. We had more days of advanced polls this election than we have ever had. And we had the lowest voter turnout in the province. That tells me we have a systemic problem that needs serious review. But now I want to go, and I don't know, Mike, whether you want to talk about this, but I think I'd love to hear from you. The biggest losers in this election, besides the Ontario people in my mind, were the Liberals and the New Democrats. The Liberals more so, New Democrats less. New Democrats preserved their position in the House and actually solidified their voter base, which is surprising for me to say. I think they ran a lousy campaign. And as one of the members of the NDP executive said to me, even if we brought back Tommy Douglas from the dead without serious structural changes within the party, he ain't going to win in Ontario. For everyone, I'd love to hear, and maybe start with Bill, because you've done this for so long. I think that the Liberals are in real trouble. 23% of the vote and 8 seats is a serious problem. And if I understand correctly, they are in serious financial problems, if not close to bankruptcy. as well. They get none of the perks of the legislature. Mike, you're one person in the legislature. I think you can do it better than eight can do it, actually, because you don't have the problem of a caucus without the resources. So this is why I really want to hear. We had 60% of the population that voted against this government. So bloody what? It doesn't matter. Bill.
Well, I mean, the Liberals had the second most votes in the province and they have eight seats. And the party that was just behind them, within 0.3 of a percentage point, to be fair, has 31 seats. The reason for that is Liberal vote is much less regionalized. It's much more broadly spread across the country, across the province. The NDP vote is highly regionalized in the north, in Hamilton, in downtown Toronto, and to a certain degree in downtown Ottawa, where they've historically done well in Ottawa Centre. And that just, they have a lot of activists in the area that help them out. So yeah, the Liberal Party has a problem. It has money problems. The NDP has been there. In fact, I would argue a few years ago, Kathleen Wynne bailed the NDP out by restoring public funding because the NDP was way down there. And they got a big chunk of change from public funding from the Wynne government that put them back on the rails. I think things are going to be tough for the Liberal Party of Ontario for some time. But the one advantage the Liberal Party has, if they have some support from their federal cousins, is the Liberals in this country were born on third base. It is the sort of the back. It is the fallback vote for many people. It is the parked place, and they have an advantage that maybe other political parties don't have. But it was just the distribution. The power of incumbency to a certain degree saved the NDP too, because that does mean something. We picked up two new seats, both in areas of regional strength for us historically. But otherwise it was all about incumbency, which the Liberals did not have. They started with eight seats, they finished with eight seats, despite increasing their vote profoundly. They just didn't have the concentration to make the difference. And the Liberal Party of Ontario, in fact, the Liberals generally are not as ground-based as the other political parties.
Mike, do you want to add your 2 cents worth in, or is this too close to the bone for you?
Well, I'll just say, don't underestimate the resiliency of the Liberal brand. It's probably one of the strongest political brands in the world, actually. I don't know if it was you, Phil, or Bill. I think it was you, Phil, who said ground game, or Bill, one of you. The people who won, particularly, I would say, the NDP, MPPs, and I'd say myself here in Guelph, had far superior ground games to what I saw in any riding with the Liberals. And so the Liberals have really coasted on brand and the air game and not the ground game. And when you're scraping your way back from not having a lot of existing seats, the ground game is just vital. And so that, I just goes back to my original comments, and this is for every political party, but I'd say especially those of us who are progressives, that we are going to have to mobilize ground game over the next 4 years to push back against the Ford government's agenda.
Mike, just unpack your position in the legislature a little bit. I made a statement that I think that you are in a better position than the Liberals are, because, no disrespect, because there's one of you and they've got eight and you don't have the resources. I'm not certain that people are really aware of what that means. I was wondering if you could just outline what some of the challenges might be, both for yourself and for the Liberals, in a situation where you have no formal recognition.
Yeah, so I'll just say that I think part of why a lot of people have said I punch well above my weight and have an outsized influence in the legislature is I'm used to doing it with nothing. I've never had anything. And so when you're used to having no resources, you know, like you just know what to do. And so I would say my experience in the last 4 years with the Liberal caucus, because we worked together a lot because we were all technically independents. So I've already been having conversations with the current Liberals around how we're going to all work together again. They took a lot of direction from me and from my office because they didn't have an army of staffers that they were used to telling them what to do. And because we've never had that, we just did it. And so I will say that we were able to secure a lot of rights for independents in the last legislature that didn't exist prior to 2018. And that's all in the standing order. So the government could, and they have the power to change those standing orders. But the way the rules of the legislature work right now, we'll still have a lot of opportunities to participate and to be effective in the legislature. The bigger issue is are you able to mobilize and do that with limited or no resources? So the NDP, for example, will have like a $5, $6 million constituency budget, or caucus budget, and the Greens and Liberals will have nothing. And so that does make a huge difference when it comes to being able to do research, media, just the work of the legislature. That does definitely put the Liberals and Greens at a significant disadvantage. Though I would argue the Greens have kind of figured out how to live with that disadvantage because we've never had an advantage.
Listen, we put a lot of energy into talking about what went wrong in the election campaign. A lot of things did. And the fact is it's a competition too, and things may not be entirely fair. We're not all starting at the same line. But in a democracy, when we want to ask why what went wrong, how can we lost, how can we didn't do better, whatever, we have a tendency to blame outside forces. But political parties have to look at themselves and ask what they did wrong and take responsibility, because, you know, whoever you are, the NDP, the Liberals in this case, you didn't speak to voters and convince them to vote for you for whatever reason. And you have to own that and ask why. What changes do I have to make? The NDP was in opposition for 4 years. For most of that, the Liberal Party didn't have a leader and it never had party status. Yet, look where we ended up. And we have to be really serious with the changes that have to happen. And we have to look at ourselves before we look anywhere else. The last point I wanted to make was about Brit. Brit said there were a lot of voters. There are 1.3 million voters in Ontario with disabilities, and I'm not sure they were addressed in the campaign meaningfully at all, except perhaps by, in the case of ODSP, in particular, by the Green Party.
Thanks, Bill. A fairly thoughtful conclusion there that I think we should all take to heart. I do have another question for you, and then I think I'm going to turn it over to Tanya. Is Joel Hardin going to go to NDP hell for the comments he made on election night?
He made comments before about the need for new leadership before the leader announced that she wasn't going to run again. I think he said what was on the minds of a vast majority of New Democrats activists. And no, I think he's not going to New Democrat hell for that. He's certainly not going there in my estimation. Whether I support him if he runs for leader or not, that's a different story. But I think his comments were on the money.
Great. I actually heard from somebody who's in this breakfast today that there were about 100 New Democrats on something called New Democat last night, talking about the New Democratic leadership race and exactly the comments that you just made and that Hardin made. It's not about leadership. It's about restructuring. Yeah. Like I said, one member of the NDP executive said, you put Tommy Douglas in Ontario and you're starting him off far behind the eight ball right now.
Yes, but I also don't want to let them off the hook for some colossally, colossally amateurish decisions during the election campaign. They particularly around focusing the campaign almost exclusively on the leader on the basis of no meaningful statistical evidence, although they told their people over and over again that there wasn't. It was a bizarre, I don't understand it, why the decision was made, and it didn't work for them. And it's one of those cases, not the first time I've come across it, where you're told one thing by the party strategist about what reality is, then you actually go out to talk to voters, and then you find out the reality is something different entirely. But I think if you start off by talking to voters, you'll be in a much better place.
Well, thank you very much. And just a quick check for Aisha and from Juanita and from Mike. Any summary comments before I pass it over to Tanya for the most important part of this meeting, which is announcements? Mike, anything more you want to say? We know where to find you.
I think I've talked enough. So I'll just reiterate this message one last time. We have to organize at the grassroots over the next 4 years.
Aisha, what about yourself?
Yeah, I want to be much more engaged. That's the key. I want to be much more engaged. There's so much that I can do to improve. And I agree with you, Bill, we have to look at ourselves, right? What can I do differently? If I'm going to do the same old thing and expect different results, it's not going to work that way. So what can I do to improve? How can I better connect with people? How can I be much more engaged with the community if I'm wanting to represent? So I want to thank you all again for this morning and an opportunity to share my experience.
And my breakfast companion, Juanita, even though you're sitting across the restaurant now. What about you?
I agree with what Mike and Aisha said about building in the community. I'm also thinking a lot about what Bill McBain said about being aspirational. And I think that's one of the things that the Communist Party has been doing, but I think it can be more of a focus going forward. Thanks.
I want to thank all of our guests today. This has been a fabulous deconstruction of the Ontario election. I think better than anything I've actually heard. And we never got to the media, which I think did an appalling job of the election. But here at the Breezy Brothers Breakfast, we do it better. Pronto. Thanks very much to all of you. Tanya, let's get on with the very important announcements.
We've got a council meeting on June 13th, and one of the most important things on the agenda is the official plan amendment with regards to the Emma Earle Footbridge. There are several other public meetings. If you have something to say, please register by tomorrow at 10 a.m. Have your say about transit and the digital displays. Please complete the survey by June the 12th. Have your say about the transit fare strategy. And this is with regards to youth aged 13 to 18. Please complete the survey by June the 15th. Have your say about the OR lands. Please tell the city what you like about the OR lands, what sites are important and why. Do this by June the 22nd. Have your say about Metrolinx. You can have your say about a lot of things in the next little while. Please do the thing about Metrolinx by June the 22nd. There is a noon hour concert series downtown. Tomorrow it's Snowbird. The Guelph Wellington Seniors Association is having a big event tomorrow, Friday, June the 10th from 9 till 4. There's going to be meet and greet, activity group information sessions, a euchre tournament, art exhibitions, and a concert in the afternoon featuring the Silver Tones and the debut of the Silver Strummers, which is a ukulele orchestra. So please Google GWSA Guelph for more information. The Multicultural Festival is happening at Riverside Park from June 10th to the 12th. There's food, music, arts, crafts, dancing, a midway Highland Games, and so much more. June 21st is National Indigenous Day. There will be a celebration of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples event at Riverside Park between 5:30 and 8:30 p.m. Municipal Campaign School is having an event to raise women's voices on Saturday, June 18th from 9 till noon. Please Google Raising Women's Voices Guelph to get to the Eventbrite site. And finally, next week on Breezy Breakfast, we are talking about community wealth candidates. And our guest is Colin Bruce Anthes. He is an organizer for Community Wealth Candidates. And that is it for today. Thank you very kindly for joining us and see you next week.
That's it for today. Thanks to the Breezy team of Kevin Bowman, Morgan Dandy, Tanya Gaver, Phil Out, and Jia Yuyan. Music provided by Jules Germ.